صلي على محمد.
Iran's parliament speaker calls for the prosecution of Israeli authorities for applying an apartheid system and committing crimes against Palestinians. The World Bank says Lebanon's economic collapse is likely to rank among the world's worst financial crises since the mid-19th century. And four major global organizations calling for a more equal distribution of corona vaccines amid rising concerns about vaccine inequality between wealthy and poor nations. Welcome. Beginning with our top story, Iranian Parliament Speaker Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf is calling on Muslim nations to continue support for the Palestinian people against the Tel Aviv regime. He called for the prosecution of the Israeli authorities for applying an apartheid system and committing crimes against Palestinians. Ghalibaf made a comment in a virtual address to the second general conference of the Parliamentary Assembly of the Economic Cooperation Organization. The two-day event kicked off in Pakistan on Tuesday. The Iranian Parliament Speaker said that his country is ready to cooperate with the ACO member states to fight Islamophobia. ACO is an Asian intergovernmental organization that aims to strengthen cooperation among member states. Dozens of former European officials have called for an end to political interference in a probe by the International Criminal Court into Israeli war crimes against Palestinians. We've discussed that issue in our News Review program. Let's take a listen.
It's time now for the News Review of this bulletin. Dozens of senior figures have condemned efforts to obstruct an investigation by the International Criminal Court into Israeli war crimes against Palestinians. In an open letter, more than 50 European ex-officials decried and called for an end to political interference in the ICC's inquiry. In the letter, they said attempts to discredit the court and block its work cannot be tolerated. Top figures expressed concern over, quote, unwarranted public criticism of the ICC's probe into Israeli atrocities against Palestinians. They also lashed out at the former U.S. President Donald Trump for imposing sanctions against ICC staff members and their families, a move that was later reversed by Trump's successor Joe Biden. The letter is also seen as a rebuke to British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who last month criticized the ICC for investigating Israeli crimes. Let's get the latest on that from Brussels. Jerome Hughes is our correspondent who joins us, and for an analysis we have Mick Napier from the Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign joining us from Edinburgh. Okay, first over to you, Jerome. Tell us about this letter, what actually prompted it. Well, we know what prompted it, but how it gained the momentum that it did in order for it to be written in a letter requesting no obstruction for the ICC probe.
Yeah, Cathy, well, I think there's no doubt about it. We're seeing a growing push against Israel and the actions of Israel. I mean, we see it in national parliaments politically. We see it amongst groups of academics, civil society organizations, and we're sort of seeing this again now in terms of people trying to push back against interference with the criminal court. And I think perhaps, you know, it's fair to say that actually the cause for justice for the Palestinians has actually been helped by Donald Trump, because people are growing, a bigger audience saw the injustice that he was bringing with some of the moves he was making. And also, you know, the character of Benjamin Netanyahu was probably exposed to a wider audience as well because of his close relationship with Donald Trump. But even with this push against the actions of Israel, there is still a massive Israel lobby around the world. It's very powerful. It's very well funded. We see it when actions are trying to be taken against the atrocities committed by Israel, that there's always this pushback. We even see it in the European Parliament. I mean, the European Parliament here in Brussels passes so many resolutions condemning the actions of Israel and so on, but then it just, that's where it ends. When it gets to the European Council, it's actually never even discussed by EU leaders. So there is that problem. And obviously, you know, when we talk like this, we're often accused of being anti-Semitic or something like this. Nothing could be further from the truth. We know that the largest population of Jews living in the region outside of Israel are actually living in Iran. This has got nothing to do with religious intolerance. It's got to do with the war crimes, the crimes against humanity, and the appalling atrocities that Israel has committed against Palestinians.
Okay, so McNabb here, let's take a look at this in terms of the sincerity factor, which appears to be there, but when it comes to action, that needs to be translated to something tangible. One aspect to this is that the EU is actually Israel's largest trading partner. Maybe they can start from there.
Well, yes. Clearly, there's some kind of crisis, and it's a crisis in the ability of Israel's allies to defend against an increasingly aroused public opinion. The figures and the studies of public opinion are incontestable. It's very hostile to Israel across the entire EU. So why at this time? I think Netanyahu was very difficult to defend. Pro-Israel commentators made that point. The new ambassador to Britain is a monstrous figure who's publicly in favor of ethnically cleansing Palestinian, including citizens of Israel. And now we see the possibility of Naftali Bennett replacing Netanyahu. So there's a huge difficulty in trying to defend this. Now, for a long time, it's been quite brazen. British prime ministers have defended Israel as being reserved and moderate, even while it was slaughtering people in Gaza. But there does come a time when they recognize that they have to act. And that's the case now. It's also the case that Trump was a monstrous figure also, who instituted sanctions against the International Criminal Court. Biden has rescinded them. But of course, the Americans will exert every diplomatic and economic muscle that they have to try to get this into the long grass. They'll threaten smaller countries with aid withdrawal. All sorts of sanctions will be brought to bear. Now, my own prime minister, I hate to use the pronoun my, but Boris Johnson has given Israel a green light. He simply said during the current killings that's okay, that Israel has a right to defend itself. And it's all done in front of the public. I've spoken and attended very, very large demonstrations over the last 2 weeks in Scotland, and I've been struck by how much more knowledgeable young and other people are compared to previous massacres and previous cycles of mass demonstrations, because they can see the Israeli army boasted that every bullet that they fired on the Gaza periphery landed on the spot that they wanted it to land. Yet we know that they maimed tens of thousands of Palestinians. One sniper boasted on Israeli TV he'd shattered 42 Palestinian knees during one particular shift. And it's very well known. Social media is Israel's greatest enemy. The corporate media is still very compliant, but millions of people know the reality because Palestinians, they may not have guns across the West Bank and inside 48, but they have cameras, they have phones with cameras. And that information is eating away at the ability of Israel's allies to defend it.
Okay, thank you for that. Mick Napier, Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign from Edinburgh. And thank you, Jerome Hughes, a correspondent there from Brussels. Wish we had more time. And with that, we come to an end for the News Review.
Welcome back. Let's move on. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu seems to be out of tricks to prolong his political career. The possibility is gained momentum after his arch foe, Naftali Bennett, sought to squeeze him out of premier seat by working with the opposition leaders to build an alternative cabinet. Mona Kendall has more in her report.
Benjamin Netanyahu's 12-year reign as Israel's prime minister is much likely to end on Sunday. Naftali Bennett, a far-right politician leading Yamina Party, and Yair Lapid, a centrist and opposition leader of Yesh Atid Party, moved closer to forming a coalition after four inconclusive parliamentary elections in 2 years and Netanyahu's repeated failure to form a coalition. Netanyahu accused Bennett of trying to form a leftist ruling structure that would ensure his rise to premiership. He said that Bennett had been sowing discord, division, and hatred against him.
There are many reasons behind efforts by the Israeli parties working together to oust Netanyahu. He has always declared himself as the only leader of Israel. He has no rival even within his own party. Meanwhile, he has failed to form a coalition so far. Therefore, removing him from the political scene could serve as a strong blow on the Likud and Netanyahu himself.
Bennett said his party would work with the opposition leaders to build an alternative cabinet. Observers say the alliance between eight relatively small parties with a diffuse range of ideologies won't be easy. But if they succeed, they had agreed that the prime minister's post would rotate between Bennett, a former settler leader who rejects the concept of a sovereign Palestinian state and champions the religious right, and Lapid, who is considered a voice of secular centrists.
It's not an easy mission. We are speaking about the ideological differences between two opposition parties. It's a complex decision for Bennett. They have to tackle lots of problems before forming a cabinet. Moreover, Netanyahu won't remain silent. He may take people with right-wing tendency to the streets to hamper efforts by any future cabinet.
Netanyahu has been holding on to power for the past 12 years. His popularity has, however, suffered an unprecedented plunge among the Israelis, who have been holding regular rallies outside his residence for months on end to force him to resign. Today, experts say nothing must be taken for granted because what's being described as the anti-Netanyahu cabinet of change is still not an accomplished fact. They say Netanyahu is not simply departing the scene without a fight for remaining in office. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
The World Bank has ranked Lebanon's economic crisis as one of the worst the world has seen in more than 150 years. According to a report published on Tuesday, the economic and financial crises in Lebanon are likely to be among the top 10 or possibly the top 3 since the mid-19th century. The report also predicts that Lebanon's economy will shrink by nearly 10% in 2021 and that there is, quote, no clear turning point on the horizon. The increasingly dire economic situation over the past 18 months in the Arab country is widely blamed on corruption, the COVID-19 pandemic, and devastating explosion at Beirut port. Lebanon has been without a government since last August amid both political and financial issues. Yemeni Minister of Information Daif Ala al-Shami has visited the liberated areas of Jizan. That's a Yemeni territory occupied by Saudi Arabia for almost a century.
We are near the city of Al Khuba, which is still under Saudi control. But these mountains and this plain, which were in the hands of the Saudis and their mercenaries, were liberated with the help of God. We can see Mount Al Amud, which overlooks the city. Army and Ansarullah forces are stationed on that mountain.
The minister added that Yemeni troops liberated large parts of the occupied territories of the country. He said forces have also entered areas which are still under Saudi control. The Yemeni information minister praised the achievement and said that the Saudi domination has been shattered by God's grace. Now, four major global organizations are calling the group of seven wealthy nations to commit themselves to equal distribution of coronavirus vaccines. The call was made jointly by the heads of the World Health Organization, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Trade Organization. They said dangerous gaps in vaccination programs have fueled the emergence of new and more contagious coronavirus variants. They warned there will be no broad-based recovery from the pandemic without global access to vaccination. The organizations urged the G7 countries to allocate $50 billion in funding to vaccinate the world. The pandemic has killed more than 3.5 million people globally. Vaccines have been in short supply for poorer nations, and that's because major economies bypassed the UN-backed vaccine distribution program and purchased the overwhelming share of available jabs. Now, this is while India has registered its lowest spike in daily COVID infections since April 8th, some 127,000 new cases in one day. According to the health ministry, total tally of infections now standing at 28.2 million. Overall deaths have reached 331,900 after almost 2,800 fatalities in one day. Daily deaths have seen a sharp decrease from their peak of 4,000 last month. 24-hour infections there have also declined the past week, but things are different in Malaysia, where virus cases and deaths are surging. May alone accounted for more than 40% of the country's total COVID deaths that are now almost 2,800. A On Tuesday, Malaysia imposed national lockdown to battle the COVID surge. Now let's take a look at the situation. In Iran, the country has reported 171 more COVID fatalities in one day. And that raises the death toll to more than 80,000. The health ministry also reported 10,000 new infections in a day, bringing the total cases to 2.9 million. Nearly 2.5 million people have recovered. The government imposed strict nationwide restrictions in April, following a surge in infections and deaths. Iran also launched its own national vaccination campaign in early February. More than 3.7 million people have received the first doses of the COVID vaccine. 500,000 people have been fully vaccinated. Russia has described as the tip of the iceberg recent revelations that a U.S. spy and its European allies with Denmark's help. Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova said that NATO member states and EU countries deliberately dodged the subject related to the U.S. espionage. She added that those countries have no idea what's happening on their soil. Now, that after the Danish media said the Denmark Secret Service helped the U.S. spy on European politicians, including German Chancellor Merkel, between 2012 and 2014. Intelligence was allegedly collected on other officials from Germany, France, Sweden, and Norway. French President Emmanuel Macron and Merkel have demanded explanations over the allegations. Indigenous groups in Canada are demanding a nationwide search for mass graves of former residential school sites. The group said that the government should also help research undocumented deaths and burials at the sites. Last week, a mass grave containing remains of 215 children was found at a former residential school in the state of British Columbia. The bodies belonged to students, some as young as three. Canada forcibly sent more than 150,000 Indigenous children to residential schools between 1831 and 1996. A 2015 investigation documented abuse, malnutrition, and rape at the schools. The probe called the system a cultural genocide for forcing kids to abandon their native language and convert to Christianity. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has called the system a shameful reality in his country. Now, Colombian demonstrators have once again clashed with security forces as the country undergoes its second month of anti-government rallies. Police fired tear gas at protesters in Fatacativa, a municipality near the capital of Bogota. Clashes erupted while protesters were attending the funeral of an indigenous man who was reportedly killed during a previous demonstration. Anger has grown against social and economic policies of the government of President Iván Duque. The demonstrations began in April over a proposed tax rise. The government later withdrew the plan, but the protests grew wider against police violence, poverty, and health crisis. Dozens of people have been killed since then. The United Nations has called for an independent probe into the deadly unrest in the South American country.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
The limelight. European Union tourists coming to the United Kingdom have told of being fingerprinted, detained, and treated like liars by border officials before trying to travel through the Channel Tunnel or by ferry at Calais. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnists Lisa O'Carroll and Giles Tremlett. The piece is titled, EU Tourists Complain of Fingerprinting at UK Border. European Union tourists coming to the United Kingdom have told of being fingerprinted, detained and treated like liars by border officials before trying to travel through the Channel Tunnel or by ferry at Calais. Sergio D'Alberti, a 51-year-old Italian hotel manager currently out of work due to the COVID pandemic, told The Guardian he was held for 7 hours at the French port of Calais after UK border force officials concluded it would be a potential drain on the benefits system. They said his €4,500 in funds was not sufficient to cover all reasonable costs in relation to your being without working or accessing public funds, and that his lack of return ticket and job added to suspicion that he was lying. Sergio D'Alberti planned a road trip from his home in Côte d'Azur in southern France as a pleasant diversion during the pandemic on his way to Ireland to meet his wife's family in County Kerry. Instead, he said, he was held for hours, fingerprinted and photographed, like I was a criminal. As he had not booked every hotel for his trip after quarantine and he did not have a return ticket. It was a horrible experience. I'm disgusted the way I've been treated. I've never been so humiliated in my life. I will never ever go to the United Kingdom again. To me, the United Kingdom no longer exists. It is not in my vocabulary. After Calais, it is the North Pole, he said. His ordeal in Calais was matched by the experience of Chloe, a Danish pastry chef who had made a 10-hour trip from Jutland in Denmark with her boyfriend. I just went with him to visit his family. I have a job here in Denmark and was planning to stay for 3 weeks. Like D'Alberti, Chloe was turned away 2 weeks ago, but decided to return home because border force agents at Calais in northern France had told her that if she turned around voluntarily, then her encounter with them would not be registered. They issued her with an IS-81 stamp on her passport, indicating a person had made an application to enter, but no decision on that could be made because they had subsequently withdrawn it. When she made another attempt to enter the United Kingdom, arriving at Heathrow Airport on Sunday night, she discovered the full impact of the IS-81, which flagged her previous attempt, and she spent the next 5 hours crying in a Heathrow Airport detention room. The despite her return ticket for 16th of June and insistence that she was exercising her right as a European Union citizen to visit the United Kingdom without a visa, she feared Border Force officials planned to expel her and prevent her from seeing her boyfriend. Chloe was allowed out of Heathrow Airport at 10:30 p.m. after what she described as a horrific experience. Border Force officials could not explain why it took them so long or why she had been deprived of her freedom. They had also searched her bags and questioned her about her job in Denmark and also put questions to her about her parents. Chloe said she felt Border Force tried to push her into saying that she was coming to live permanently and illegally in Britain. She asked me why I was entering the United Kingdom and I said to visit my boyfriend, she said. She immediately said, live with your boyfriend, so I repeated, visit. Already she was putting words into my mouth. Sergio D'Alberti, who's starting a new job in Bayonne in France in July, claimed his unemployment status was twisted into a sinister motive for travel by officials and that his open-ended plans were treated with deep suspicion. They fingerprinted me. I asked them, is this normal to fingerprint visitors to Britain? Do you do this to everyone at the border? They fingerprinted every finger. Then they took a picture of my face like I was a suspect. A spokesperson for the Home Office said, we expect Border Force to treat all arrivals with respect and consider each passenger's situation on an individual basis. The British public expect us to check that everyone entering the United Kingdom has the right to do so. And passengers may be asked questions to establish the basis on which they're seeking to enter the United Kingdom. Under Immigration Rules, Appendix 5, the onus is on the tourist to satisfy the decision maker they are a genuine visitor. This means the applicant must satisfy officials that they will leave the United Kingdom after their visit. They will not live in the UK or make the UK their home. They are genuinely seeking entry for a permitted purpose and must have sufficient funds to cover everything in their trip, including return journey and any costs incurred, including that of any planned private medical treatment.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Dark Review with me, Camelia Shambayaki. In today's show, we're going to be discussing Warriors from the North, directed by Nasib Farah and Sorenstein Jespersen. And joining me in the studio, we have Rich Klein, who is the Vice Chair of the London Film Critics Circle and Chair of the Critics Circle Film Awards. And beside him is Masood Shajareh, who is the Chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission. Now, Warriors from the North is a complex and multi-layered narrative that gives you a chilling insight into what fuels the current trend of Western Muslim youth leaving the West to join radical extremist groups abroad, such as Al-Shabaab, which is an Al-Qaeda-linked militant group in Somalia. The documentary tells the story of a Danish-Somalian boy in Copenhagen who fell victim to Al-Shabaab recruiters.
Young men in our early 20s, we missed action. I was very attracted by being able to do something and stop being just one of them who's looked down on, you know. And now Mohammed's in Somalia. He's a warrior for Al-Shabaab. His father, Abukar, is afraid that his son will also become a suicide bomber.
I joined Al-Shabaab because I had nothing else to do. Nothing left for it but to drink.
We were a true group. We felt that Al-Shabaab showed us respect. I'd never experienced respect like that before.
And first of all, welcome both of you to the show. And Rich, as our guest film critic, what was your take on Warriors from the North?
Well, it's really, really well made, and it's got that kind of Danish filmmaking sheen to it. Beautifully shot, very clever use of archival footage and stills, and I mean they make a lot of use of videotape that they get of these warriors, kind of
so-called
really
warriors.
Chilling, yeah. Really chilling videotapes. And but then there's also a lot of footage shot in Copenhagen that's very beautifully shot, very cleverly put together. It's only an hour long. It's a short documentary, so it doesn't. It's not really a kind of comprehensive look at the situation. It's a very specific story about these specific people and in their situation, even though it does have references to the larger story.
And for our viewers who haven't seen the film, in a nutshell, could you just briefly describe what it's about?
basically, it centers on this man who calls himself the Shadow, because he doesn't want to be identified. So you only see him as a shadow on screen, just his silhouette. And he tells his story about being a disaffected youth, basically had a bad breakup, and tries to recover by partying and getting drunk. And of course, his family doesn't approve of that, so he doesn't really have his family around him. And he's on his own, and he makes all these friends who take him into this closed circle and kind of groom him to go to Somalia, which is where he's from originally, but he hasn't been back there since he was a child. Mm-hmm. So and he tells the story quite coherently. You understand why he fell into this group. He loves the camaraderie of these other men, and then that group dissolved. But some of the men went to mm-hmm. Somalia.
And we'll actually touch more on that.
And that's where the film veers. It follows one of his friends, who has disappeared in Somalia, and the friend's father is trying to find him there. So you get that parallel story of the father trying to find his friend.
It's pretty much essentially that's what happens. We don't want to give too much away, but Masood, I'd like your take on the documentary. As someone who works on tackling Islamophobia, did you have the same take as Rich?
No, I think the film didn't go out to be Islamophobic. I mean, I actually think it was quite clear that. But I think the environment and the way that the whole thing is within our society, it really came out that way, because, you know, I, as the film was about the franchise sort of youth and getting involved and doing something which is unsavory, you know, say the least. But that happens to a lot of our youth, both Muslim and non-Muslim. And it really didn't tackle that, you know, that aspect. It's sort of, and sort of what is sort of tackled is that here Islam, you know, it's give the perception that here was an Islam violent sort of thing, an output for them to go and do this. And you know, the shots, for example, sort of having discussion in the mosque or having sort of discussion outside the shop with Arabic writing in the back and so forth, it really created that association. Mm-hmm. While in reality, the other side of the story was saying, really, this is not the case. This is just a bunch of youth who are really lost.
They're
saying
there's multiple messages in this film.
It is, but I think that message was mixed up with some other messages which were sort of visual messages, and which is conflicting one another.
Well, that's a really good point, and I'd like to take a brief break now from the discussion. Rich, what did you make of this story and his struggle to bring back his son?
It's quite a wrenching story, because he's really worried about his son. He knows that the life of one of these kids who goes to Somalia tends to last about 1 or 2 years before they're involved in some sort of bombing, which is just horrible to think about, for a father to think about his son being taken off there. He doesn't understand why his son even fell into this group. It's pretty wrenching. It's very intense. And also, the Shadow, the other character, who was a good friend of Muhammad, so remember, is talking about his friend who's just gone, and he doesn't know what's happened to him.
And I think one of the interesting points about this father figure, he probably represents the voice of all the parents struggling to bring back their children who are lost to extremist groups, is that the father is nothing like his son. And I think many people might be surprised to see that usually the idea is that the children become radicalized by their parents. But this isn't the case, is it, Masood?
No, I think this is where I think the documentary failed. Although it was giving messages that strengthened that, but it failed to actually say that, you know, this conveyor belt sort of that is sort of usually topped by British government and other governments, that, you know, people start one side and then eventually they become radicalized at the end, which is being disputed by all academics and indeed by intelligence services, but it still is being pushed as a basis of our anti-terrorism sort of strategy. It's not factual, it's actually false. And, you know, this guy, if anything, was quite a misguided group of people, very alienated, all of them, and out of boredom and alienation of where they were actually dragged into that arena. And this was, it was a fact, but wasn't really strengthened.
But this documentary surely is about the personal stories of the individuals, not so much addressing the politics of the situation.
No, but you see, it's very difficult not to, you know, because at the end of the day, that is what makes this very moving. And you know, the, for example, many of other youth in our society, they might not be Muslim, they might go and join a gang, and they actually end up going as much wrong as these guys gone. And that
or
is
they
something
get into a right wing group that commits atrocities at home.
I mean this is you know is a really a challenge for our society to first of all to understand this phenomenon and then to address it if possible. And this is sort of did not actually reach that. Look, these youth, although they got involved in this thing, but they were no different to other youth in the society who get misguided and out of boredom and have nothing to do, and of the fact that, you know, I mean, they were saying that was a group of them coming together, it was a family for them. So there was something really lacking in the society.
Rich, would you agree with Masood, what he's saying there, that this documentary should have given more context to what's happening?
I mean, I think since it's just a one-hour documentary, it's very short, and I think they were specifically trying to tell this one story. But they do bring in stories from other people. They have the one, there's the extensive video clips of the boy who went from the UK to Somalia, and then he got out of Al-Shabaab. And I wish they had replaced that story with another story of someone in Denmark who found the family in his mosque and didn't, you know, and found what he was missing, you know.
That's
and I thought that was what was missing in the film, was the story of someone who found the positive side of Islam, the peaceful side, and, you know, and didn't succumb to violence, which isn't really part of Islam.
Well,
and the film does make that clear. It makes it clear that this violence and these kind of, you know, bombers are not actually Islamic. That's not part of Islam.
I think that's a really important point, that you make that point. And I'm afraid we'll just have to pause it just for now.
Al-Shabaab looked for vulnerable young teenagers who had problems with their families, who had problems with the government, who had issues with police, who are an easy target for Al-Shabaab because the person's mind is already crafted and polluted. You know, in his own mind, he doesn't trust the police because the police are the ones that are locking him up and putting him in jail. He doesn't really trust his family because his family doesn't give him enough support. So what does he do? He comes forward, like him. He joins Al-Shabaab, ends up being killed himself.
You really get a sense of how alienated and isolated these young Somalis feel in Denmark. Rich, do you think this documentary was successful in outlining the reasons why these young Danish Somalis go and fight for Al-Shabaab?
It kind of hints at the situation in Europe, where a Somali, young Somali teenagers are treated like outsiders, so they don't feel like they belong in the society where they've grown up. And these young men have grown up in Denmark, but they don't feel Danish. And they don't really feel Somalian either, because they never lived there, really. So they feel like they don't have any home. And it does really convey that idea. I don't know what's the answer to that. We need to have more open societies that accept people. And maybe the trick is to target prejudice and these ideas that the general public have that marginalize groups of people. But that happens on every level of society, not just ethnically. And
yeah, no, of course. I saw you nodding your head there, Masood. Would you agree with what Rich just said?
Yes, I think, I mean, our society is much more complicated than one issue results in one thing. You know, it's not as simple as that. Alienation is one aspect. And the other aspect is that these are the youth who, some of them came across the way that they were being interviewed. They were concerned about injustices around the world. And they wanted to do something about it, which is a very amicable feeling to have. But instead of that feeling being strengthened and supported in the right way of addressing those things, the only thing they could find was actually going and being recruited by these guys. And that is actually a failure that I see in our society day in, day out. And indeed, the government policies and so forth exaggerate this. And the reality is that there are forcing us not to be political, not to address these issues, not to talk, you know, the elephant in the room is being ignored. And the reality is that these youth, and indeed the other youth, are not given the right tools to be, you know, activists in a real sense for for the right thing, for the right reason, and for the with the right tools. And if you remove that from any youth, you're actually leaving open very negative aspect to sneak in, because youth want to do something. They want to be part of the solution. And I think you're failing them in that way. And the other aspect is that we are giving wrong messages as a society. We actually tell, you know, through our policies overseas and things, we're actually giving a message that end justifies the means. You know, and that message ultimately is a terrorist justification. And if we give that message could be interpreted and used in other arenas, and people go towards these sort of extreme ways of addressing something which is very, very noble.
And Rich, I get the sense from this documentary that the filmmakers are trying to, while not necessarily directly sympathize with the recruits, but and at the same time they're condemning and showing how horrific their crimes are. Are you getting that sense that the recruits are victims in their own right as well?
Yeah, the film clearly presents them as victims. It presents them as good children who have been brainwashed and kind of convinced that this is the way that they should act and mm-hmm. what they should do. Mm-hmm. There's definitely a sense that it's presenting them as it's not their fault. You know, they're 16-year-olds who have been convinced that what they're doing is the right thing to mm-hmm. do, and it does. I mean, our discussion is going way beyond the material in the film, because it is a short film and it is very concentrated on this very specific story.
And that's the merit to the film, because it raises many serious questions.
It causes you to think about these things that it doesn't really address, and that's quite important.
And we're going to talk about sort of the vulnerability issue of these recruits.
At one time, I was very seductive to doing that thing. Like, I sort of believed in it for a moment, and I was ready at one time in my life.
I used to think that killing is okay, that, you know, wrapping yourself up with suicide bomb, exploding yourself in the midst of 10,000 people or something was okay. Until I got to a certain level, you know, and I saw that it was wrong. Endless, non-stop killing for no reason. When I saw more civilians dying than actual soldiers here in Somalia, that's when I stopped being Al-Shabaab. I wish there's something I can do to stop from all these other kids from getting fooled by the same way I got fooled, you know, being tricked into just endless killing, you understand? I want to change.
So it's Mohammed Ali Omar there in that clip, and he's in hiding in Somalia but wishes to return to Europe. And Rich, are there many options for people like him if they wish to return? Because I think he fears of being prosecuted.
Yeah, I have no idea. I don't know what the legal situation for someone like that is. I don't know if he would be. I don't know what he's done. Has he
done
anything
illegal?
But in
the film, does it show that path at all?
Yeah, and The film doesn't really go into that. I found myself wishing that was a separate documentary about him, because I think his story is quite interesting and it's more hopeful because it does have a. Well, I mean, it's not finished yet because he is in hiding, but it's a fascinating story to me, and I think, you know, I'm hoping some documentary filmmaker watches this and thinks, and goes and finds him and tells his story,
and maybe helps him
reintegrate into European society.
Mm-hmm. And Nasir, following from that clip, how is it that young people, and you talked about it earlier, how this film doesn't explain why they're being tricked or how. Could you help explain why and how they're being tricked into mosques and joining extremist groups?
Well, really, it's difficult to say exactly how it's happening, but as I said, there are a number of issues.
Is it that they're taking a literalist interpretation of Islam, perhaps Wahhabism?
Well, what we know, that, and this film touches on that actually the most ignorant of Islam youth are the ones who actually get recruited. One recruit from Britain, he actually ordered Islam for Dummies, you know, just before going. So this is not something that is motivated by Islam. But unfortunately, our way of combating it is all geared towards we got to find out this Islam and change it. And unfortunately, one thing which I really felt it was wrong in the film, it gives two alternatives. One for the youth to go and be a terrorist, and the other one was actually going to club. And the third option wasn't there. I mean, you really look at hundreds and thousands of youth who are Muslim, who are practicing Muslim, who are great contributors. And this stereotyping, unfortunately, is very damaging. I think also the reality is that, you know, on one side, the end justifies mean policy, which West has been pursuing, is the problem. And the other thing is actually, we have got involved from the West with the Saudi regime in creating a new version of Islam for our political sort of needs in the Middle East region. And this has had backfired. It backfired in Afghanistan, is backfiring now, is backfiring in Syria. And out of that, it actually comes these sort of horrifying ideology of killing everyone, and which it's now interpreted that these are Muslims killing non-Muslims, but the reality is that groups like Daesh are killing more Muslims than non-Muslims, but they're killing everyone and justifying it by Islam, which is which was social engineered as a foreign policy with the help of our Saudi sort of partners.
Well, that's definitely way outside of the film, but thank you for the explanation. But I think the filmmakers in this documentary are saying it's easy to write off these groups of people, but I think they want to make viewers think that what role do the West play in radicalizing these individuals? Is that one of the messages?
I think so. Yeah, I think there is that message about why are these kids just left to fall through the cracks of the society? Why is their only option to either become radicalized or go out clubbing and getting drunk? Why are they left like that? It doesn't really examine that. It kind of raises the issue to think about, and I kind of wish it had. But then, that's another film. So. Mm-hmm.
And final thought for 30 seconds to you, Masood. Would you recommend that people see this film? I know it's only an hour long, and it raises many questions. But as a starting point, perhaps.
I do, but I say again, you know, some of the visuals conflicted with the messages it was given. So, you know, different people could watch it and come up with different things. I could imagine very clearly some Islamophobes and extreme right will see it, and it will be justification for all their visions.
So it's open to interpretation,
sure,
I guess.
I'm not sure about that. It does come out fairly strongly about immoral the actions of these suicide bombings are.
I'm sorry, gentlemen, we'll have to leave it there, but we could keep talking all day. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thanks for tuning in. I've been Camila Shambiasi.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.